Sis Mara Rasai, Imi Marasi, Shavua Tov. Again, I'd like to extend Esther's thanks for everyone coming out tonight on a cold, wet night when it would be much nicer to stay, be somewhere warm. It'll get warm. In thinking about my Dvar Torah this year, I recalled numerous discussions or arguments. Well, every discussion with that could be termed an argument. About the nature of Bechira Chofshit, which was a topic that she was fond of discussing. She was very taken with Rav Dessler's concepts of Nekudat Bechira, and she would argue around that for quite a bit. And one of the things that we used to talk about a lot was, as a test bed of the nature of Bechira Chofshit, was the whole story of Bnei Yisrael in Mitzrayim and in the Midbar, where they were continuously interacting they were continuously under the impact of revelation, which should alter the nature of their Bechira, because there's many things that are all of a sudden much harder not to believe when you are continuously being exposed to that kind of revelation. And even though this is in fact Parshat Mishpatim, what I really would like to talk about is the Meraglim. Although I do actually eventually have some kind of link into Mishpatim, but that wasn't clear to me at the outset. So this Dvar Torah is somewhat inspired from Ellie's Dvar Torah last year, so there is actually a bit of continuous there. So what I would like to really do is just simply take a look at some of the explanations of how is it possible, right? This is, for me, Meraglim represents for me the single hardest subject in the Torah to understand. How is it possible, right? How is it possible that these people that had been taken out of Mitzrayim and surrounded by the Nenei HaKavod and seen the Gilu Shechina at Matan Torah received Man, and then they all of a sudden go to just take a look, and there's numerous sources which actually, I won't go into that aspect of what it was their actual mission was meant to be, but they go to look at Eretz Yisrael, and somehow they come back saying, we can't do it. Okay? It's baffling. Not only is it baffling, it's also the single most tragic event that occurs, because it is by that act, Bnei Yisrael are doomed to wander the desert for 40 years, and a whole generation is wiped out and unable to enter the land because of this mistake. So, always been a subject that I've been interested in. Like Yosef's story from Ellie's Dvar Torah last year, there are without count explanations as to what happened. So I'd like to just quickly go over and look at some of them. So one of the ones that I've never actually connected too well to, but I actually can understand given our day and age, is there was some self-interest on the part of the Meraglim that they were afraid that they were great men of stature in the tribal society of the Midbar, but when they would go into the land and everyone would have their own homestead and Bnei Yisrael would spread out and become a people in a land, they would lose some of their special status, and therefore that self-interest impacted their judgment. There's another understanding, which is just a simple pashut pshat, which I've really also had tremendous trouble understanding, even more than the first answer, is that there was a genuine problem of belief that Hashem could do that, that Hashem could actually successfully help them conquer the land. Now we'll go on to some of the more interesting ideas that I like. The first one is I saw by Menachem Liptag, and he brings the connection to Mishpatim. He's, in this week's Parsha, Hashem says to Bnei Yisrael, Hine anochi shaleach malach lefanecha l'shmorcha baderach, right? I'm going to send a malach who is going to go in front of you. Okay? Ki im shomo tishmili b'kolo v'osite kol asher daber v'aveti et oivecha v'retzareti et tzarecha. Okay? And if you listen to everything that I say and you keep my mitzvahs and you follow the Torah, then you'll be fine. But if not, if you don't, then I will not be there to protect you. And that, Menachem Tainas, was the sin of the Meraglim. It's not that they didn't think that Hashem could protect them and that Hashem could help them conquer, but they genuinely were dubious that they would be able to maintain the necessary level of Shmirat Torah Mitzvot and maintaining a necessary spiritual level to warrant the kind of protection. And they were actually fairly pragmatic. They said, look, we keep screwing up. There's nothing that we haven't managed to blow until now. Why should we be at all confident that we as a people will be able to merit Hashem's divine protection and assistance in conquering the land? The Sfas Emes brings another idea, and he says that they were so used to and so enjoying the pure Gilui Shechina and the relationship that they had with Hashem, that they didn't actually want to deal with the reality of having to pull spirituality out of the common world. They didn't want to have to lower themselves to a more natural existence and do what was necessary to live a normal life and living in the land and which would be, you know, which could be okay with effort a spiritual existence, but it wasn't the spoon-fed pure existence that they had until then. The Netziv brings yet another idea, and he starts off by questioning why was it the Meraglim didn't go straight from Har Sinai? Why did they have to wait? And the idea that comes out of that is because the nature of the relationship between the Am and Hashem at Har Sinai was one of pure revelation and pure dependence on Hashem, and by nature the people did not need Meraglim at that state of mind. And that their state of mind, God did everything for them, so obviously God would take them into the land. It was only as they left Sinai that they began to develop an idea that really this isn't the ideal way of living. The ideal way of living is not, arguing with Sfas Emes, it's not good. We need to have a balance between spiritual and non-spirit and kind of self-dependent, and that was the and therefore they said, well, and if a more natural people would send scouts, so therefore we will send scouts because we don't want to live the kind of relationship where we're 100% dependent on God. And then for one reason or another, they fail, which is very similar to an idea I read, I think last year, maybe it was 2 years ago, from Rav Yosef Carmel, where he says that no, even more than that, the people actually did not want a spiritual existence. They wanted to live a much more natural existence. And he brings examples of their problems with the man and all sorts of other things. They wanted to live a normal, not secular, but a much more non-miraculous existence. And when they came to the land and they saw that the only way to conquer the land would be with divine aid, they rebelled. They said, wait, is there no end to this? Is there no end to our dependence upon God's direct divine revelation? Can't we live like everybody else? Now, Baruch Shit Kavanti, as I was really about an hour before the end of Shabbos, I was reading the Jerusalem Post, and in the right up there on the front page of the, whatever that internal section is called, the upfront, some guy wrote an editorial, which is very in line with what I was going to say. So, Baruch Shit Kavanti. And what he's saying in a sentence, which is what I kind of want to say, is that we are the Dor HaMidbar. And this is also my connection back to Eli's Dvar Torah from last year. Why is this whole story so interesting? Why is this story so important for us to hear about? What's so compelling? So I guess every generation had their answer, but for our generation, the answer is because we are Dor HaMidbar. We, the people living in Eretz Yisrael, are Dor HaMidbar. Those people living in Galut are certainly the Dor HaMidbar. We are at the brink of by my way of looking at it, of entering Eretz Yisrael and starting the process that God put us here to be. And it is also us who are speaking Dibat HaAretz. Okay? And that's the problem. All right? The problem... So what I want to say is basically two points. The first is that one of the reasons I picked that particular selection of Divrei Torah is because, to me, that selection of Divrei Torah encompasses many different groups' problems with coming to Israel. There are those leaders in Chutz La'aretz who, whether they know it or are conscious or unconscious, are fearful that what is another, what rabbi, Israel needs another rabbi like most of us need a third nostril. What am I going to do coming to Eretz Yisrael? Why, if I send my kehila to Eretz Yisrael, what will I do there? Okay? And then those people who say Israel is no too spiritual place for me, I can't maintain that level of spirituality in Israel. And then those people who say, no, Israel is not the spiritual place. It's, I like my spiritual existence in Muncie, Ir HaKodesh. Why would I lower myself to coming to Israel and have to deal with all that stuff there? And they've got Shemitah, and they've got this, and they've got that. There's numerous problems. But we who live in Israel are actually not any, I mean, we're a little bit better, I think, in that we've all made it here so far. But we also manage to speak tremendous Dibat Haaretz. And as we are so questioning of our right to be here, and who are we to throw other people out or not throw other people out, or should we be killing everybody out of hand or should we not? We're completely conflicted within ourselves as to what our role is in Eretz Yisrael and how are we meant to be here, okay? And people are continuously questioning, are we going to make it? Is Iran going to nuke us into the ground? Now, if I had a magical answer, obviously, I would whip it out. But the point being that the answer has to be somewhere in Kalev's response of Alo Na'aleh. Okay, what exactly, how that applies to us, I'm not going to presume to go into, but that somewhere, that is the key to our answer. And as Kalev is saying, basically, he also doesn't know, right? Kalev doesn't directly respond to the Meraglim's comment. His answer is, Hashem will help us out. I'm not trying to suggest that it's that, maybe, I'm not sure if that answer is simple or complex, but it's that answer needs understanding and it needs a practical implementation in our lives. But I think that if what I would like to suggest is that that is the key to the answer. And that's by understanding how we can apply what Kalev is saying of Alo Na'aleh. And I mean, I would suggest the whole scale of taking a look at both Yeshua and Kalev and what they do before and how Yeshua changes his name and Kalev goes and davens at Marat HaMachpelah. By using that as a metaphor, I think we should be exploring that. But certainly, Dibat HaAretz is something to just be simply avoided at all costs. Some of the things that characterized Etta, besides an inquisitive mind and, as you said, dynamic force, energy, focus, was tremendous, tremendous passion for Israel and Zionism. And in fact, the only reason I think Etta agreed to go out with me is when she found out that I was been in the States in my third year of college and didn't take a job there and chose, instead of living in New York, to come here. And so she says, oh, okay, somebody's reasonably Zionistic. And I think that the nature of this topic would have been something which Etta would have been able to have debated passionately and endlessly, and this evening should be an aliyah for her neshama and a schut for all of us. Shavua tov.
Right. Now it's my permission to pull on Dr. Rachel. Thank you very much. Is that the timekeeper?